This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting live worldwide to people of European descent wherever they may dwell. And certainly, this program is important for all people of the world. My book, Jewish Supremacism, for instance, has been translated now into over a dozen languages and is appreciated, I believe, all over the world. It addresses the world's most serious problem. People have been asking and requesting this for quite a while, an audio version of my book, Jewish Supremacism. Over the past few days, I have recorded the introduction to Jewish Supremacism, the preface that I wrote concerning the book, which kind of sums up the book in general. And that's gotten a tremendous response. And so in regard to that, I'm going to go ahead and speak different parts of the book at different times. Some chapters I'll choose will be taken from different parts of the book that I think are pertinent to the question, pertinent to the issues at hand. I'm going to begin with chapter one on the Jewish question, and we're going to go ahead and do this over a period of a few days. And the documentation for this book, obviously, can be found in my book, Jewish Supremacism. And you can go ahead and go to my website and get that chapter and also see the documentation on the citations that I mentioned. So here we go with chapter one, the Jewish question. In the first years of the 21st century, any serious criticism of the Jewish people, their religion, or the nation of Israel is considered the worst of moral crimes. Jews are the most sacred of sacred cows, and anyone with a negative word about them inevitably finds himself labeled an anti-Semite. Once a man acquires that label, true or not, nothing can redeem him from what the mass media views as the ultimate sin. So irredeemable as I am, I have the freedom to write and speak openly about a taboo that few dare to broach. You see, I'm not an anti-Semite, and I reject that epithet. However, I must address what Henry Ford called the world's foremost problem, a problem not only vital to the Palestinian people, but also to every other nation of the world. It's almost impossible in our Holocaust-saturated world to even say the word Jew without arousing emotion. The mass media of the Western world have made that so with their unrelenting packaging and repackaging of the Holocaust. As British historian David Irving says, it's spelled Holocaust with a capital H. Trademark applied for. The Holocaust has gone from being a sidebar of the Second World War to the point where the war has become an historical footnote to the Holocaust. During the 1 year before the publication of my autobiography, My Awakening, which was well over 50 years after the end of the war, my local, and local is a misnomer, for New Yorkers own it, my local newspaper, the Times-Picayune, had dozens of news and feature articles exploring varying aspects of the Holocaust. In that year, the same paper had barely mentioned the Soviet gulags, where between 10 and 30 million people died, and had only one story that mentioned the Cambodian murder of 3 million. Not a single article appeared about the slaughter of 30 to 40 million in Red China. Looking through old newspaper microfiche, I discovered that during the late 1990s, there are at least 10 times more news articles about the Holocaust than there were in the late 1940s or 1950s. Rarely does an event become more talked about and written about as it recedes in time. For instance, the subject of the Second World War took up a far greater proportion of movies, TV programs, documentaries, books, and magazine articles in the late 1950s than in the early days of the 21st century. Not so for the Holocaust. The further in time we seem to get away from the event, the more it bludgeons us as the Holocaust industry expands. It would be a Herculean task to even count all the Holocaust-oriented television news stories and specials, the documentaries and docudramas, the books, both fiction and nonfiction, the magazine articles and plays, the movies, tales of Holocaust victims, relatives, survivors, war crimes, criminals, reparations, Holocaust-related art and literature, remembrances and memorials bombard us almost daily. The sheer weight of this onslaught has prompted a number of Jews to call it Shoah business. The Holocaust Museum is located right in the most sacred soil in the American Pantheon, the Mall, near the Smithsonian Institution, financed in no small part by our tax dollars. Interestingly, it was built long before there was any real effort to build a memorial to the Second World War. It is a massive, modern version of the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum. The Holocaust is not the only Jewish trauma for which we all must grieve, for we see many painful historical accounts and dramatic Hollywood productions about other historical persecutions of the Jews. Jews are victimized by Arab terrorists in the Mideast, by fascists in Europe, even by Klansmen in the United States. A seemingly inexhaustible supply of books, articles, movies, and plays concern individual Jews who have suffered from evil anti-Semites. Each year, tens of thousands of stories about intelligent, compassionate, unselfish, creative, moral, and courageous Jews fill 2-foot TV screens and 30-foot movie screens, our newspapers, magazines, and books, our playhouses, pulpits, and podiums, our radio waves, and satellite transmissions. There are thousands of portrayals of persecuted Jews as innocent, noble, and heroic, while their opponents are portrayed as the embodiment of evil. No group on earth has better public relations than do the Jewish people. Whether it is Pharaoh's army with swords unsheathed chasing the Hebrews, or the Tsar with his anti-Semitic Cossacks, Hitler with his SS minions dressed in black, an unnamed Palestinian terrorist trying to kidnap Israeli schoolchildren, or the more intimate story of a sensitive Jew mistreated by anti-Semitic businessmen, we have all seen the anti-Semitic stereotype. We've seen the skeletal bodies and shared the Jewish pain. I know of this firsthand, for it was true for me as a young man. At age 12, reading Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl, in the school library, I recoiled from the inhumanity of anti-Semitism. By the time I had finished the book, I felt as if I had lost members of my own family. With my shirt sleeves, I covertly wiped away the moisture that had welled up in my eyes. Only a few times did I have any discussion with my father about Jews, for whom he had only praise. He spoke about my great uncle Nathan, a Methodist minister, who had converted from the Jewish faith and married my grandfather's sister, my great aunt Gussie. Father had enormous respect for Nathan and carried it over to the rest of the people he called the, quote, Hebrews, thinking that his term carried more dignity than the word Jews. At various times, he described the Hebrews as hardworking, smart, thrifty, and accomplished. Thrifty was an accolade that made a distinct impression on me because I knew that Father looked upon that particular trait as one of the most important. He hated waste of any kind. I learned that lesson at the dinner table 100 times, having to eat every bite of my food before being excused. I thought thriftiness was a Scottish tradition. But hearing that it was Jewish impressed me. Recitals of the Holocaust and Bible stories form my primary impressions of the Jewish people. Cecil B. DeMille's movie classics, such as typified by the Ten Commandments, led me to identify contemporary Jews with heroic Israelites of the Old Testament. I formed a deep admiration for the chosen people. How then did I go from my early fawning opinion of the Jews to being eventually described as a dangerous anti-Semite by the powerful Jewish advocacy organization, the ADL, the oddly named Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith? No Jew had ever overtly wronged me. I wasn't taught anti-Semitism by my parents or friends, nor did I blame them for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Although I categorically reject being labeled anti-Semitic, I certainly believe that, as any other people, Jews deserve praise for their accomplishments, and conversely, they should not be immune from criticism for their failings. The only problem is that in post-World War II, Holocaust-saturated America, any criticism of Jews as a group is viewed as the moral equivalent of condoning mass murder. If one criticizes... If one criticizes any part of Jewish history or conduct or intolerant aspects of their religion or even Israel's Zionist policies, he inevitably acquires the label anti-Semitic, a term that could not be more damaging or prejudicial. If one speaks, however, about the routine mistreatment of Indians in American history, he is not viewed as anti-American. Those who express horror about the excesses of the Spanish Inquisition are not labeled anti-Christian or anti-Spanish. The same media that prohibits even the slightest criticism of Jews has no reluctance to demean other groups, white Southerners, Palestinians, Germans, and fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims. These groups get more than their share of ridicule and debasement. The portrayal of the slack-jawed, green-toothed, ignorant, racist, hateful, murderous, rural white Southerner has become a stereotype in Hollywood films. White Southerners are not alone. One recent best-selling book is the media-promoted Hitler's Willing Executioners, a book that says the German people have something dark and evil within them, an inherent defect that makes them all guilty for the atrocities of the Holocaust. In Europe today, there are so-called hate laws that can land one in jail for saying anything critical of the Jews. In fact, there are hundreds of men who have been jailed for simply raising historical questions about the Jewish version of the Holocaust. These scholars do not allege that Jews are evil. They simply use scientific and historical evidence to dispute prevailing historical interpretations of the persecution of Jews during the Second World War. For simply offering a different historical analysis and opinion, many European scholars, such as David Irving, Dr. Robert Farason, and Jürgen Graf, have been prosecuted. On the other hand, Daniel Goldhagen, the writer of Hitler's Willing Executioners, a man who argues that Germans are inherently evil, is not persecuted for racial defamation, he is celebrated. Of course, the Arab terrorist is now a staple of Hollywood movies. In stark contrast, whenever Jews are mentioned as a group, it's always with a sort of hushed reverence. What is it about the Jewish people that evokes such unrestrained adulation and visceral hatred? Once I became convinced that people of European descent, and truly all people, have the right to protect and preserve their heritage and culture, I became a young member of the Citizens Council. Often, after class, on rainy summer days, I would go down to the office on Carondelet Street in New Orleans to do volunteer work. Many fascinating publications streamed into the office from hundreds of right-wing groups all over America. One day, as I finished helping with the council mailing, I came across some tabloid newspapers called Common Sense. It was a conservative, right-wing paper modeled after Thomas Paine's classic broadside. But the message was sharply different than Paine's. One issue's headline read, "Communism is Jewish," and another trumpeted, "NAACP, part of Red Master Plan." I also found some old issues. The huge headline in one of them predicted Red Dictatorship by 1954. However, such a warning did not seem too credible when I looked at it in 1965. I found the National Enquirer-type headlines ludicrous, but it was hard to resist reading something that scandalous, even just to laugh at it. One of the regular volunteers, Maddie Smith, an elderly lady in a flower print dress and outlandish hat, saw me snickering at the lurid headlines and simply said, "You know, it's true." "Red Dictatorship by 1954? I replied with a smile. "No," she said. "Communism is Jewish. They are the ones behind it." I thought I would humor the little old lady by politely arguing a bit with her. "Ma'am, how could that be?" I asked. "Communists are atheists. They don't believe in God. Jews believe in God, so how could they be communists?" "Do you know who Herbert Aptheker is?" she said, answering my question with one of her own. No, I replied, affecting nonchalance. She was like a tightly coiled spring waiting for release. He has the official role of the chief theoretician of the Communist Party USA, and he's listed in Who's Who in World Jewry. Leon Trotsky, the communist who took over Russia with Lenin, was in Who's Who in American Jewry. His real name is Lev Bronstein. Both are atheist communists, and both are proudly listed as great Jews in these books published by the leading rabbinical organizations of the world. Meekly, I offered, well, maybe they were listed because they were once Jews. You have so much to learn, she said with a sigh. Under Israel's law of return, you can be an atheist communist and still immigrate to Israel, and there are plenty of them, too. You only qualify to immigrate if you are a Jew, and a Jew is described simply as being of Jewish descent. So you see, you can be Jewish and still be an atheist and still be a communist, and I tell you, communism is Jewish. All Jews are communists, I retorted sarcastically. No, 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 she emphatically replied with much patience in a way that she paced her words. All Jews are not communists any more than all snakes are poisonous. But most leading communists in America are Jews, as well as most of the convicted Russian spies in America, as well as the leaders of the New Left, and historically, most of the commie revolutionaries in Russia were Jewish as well. What Mrs. Smith said made me very uncomfortable. Although it was not yet time to leave, I claimed that I had to catch my bus back home. I left the office hurriedly. Mrs. Smith had to be wrong, but I just did not have the information I needed to refute her statements. I resolved to research the issue so that I could show her why she was wrong. Something else bothered me as well, for I felt a little guilty for even talking with someone who said such terrible things about Jews. I was staunchly anti-communist, and to suggest that Jews were behind the horrors of communism was to me such a terrible allegation that my heart told me that it just could not be true. It was the first time I had been face to face with a person I presumed was an anti-Semite, and I was soon running to catch my streetcar. During the next couple of days, I avoided even thinking about the issue, and I stayed away from the Citizens Council office. Finally, I picked up and read the two copies of Common Sense I'd taken home. One copy maintained that the NAACP was a communist front organization dedicated to the eventual overthrow of our way of life. It purported that 12 Jews and one African-American had founded the NAACP, and that all the founders were dedicated Marxists with decades of documented communist affiliations. The article asserted that the only major black founder of the NAACP, W.E. Du Bois, was an avowed member of the Communist Party who immigrated to communist Ghana, where he eventually was buried. Furthermore, the scandalous publication purported that the NAACP was financed by Jewish money and always had a Jewish president. It said that a Jew, Kitty Kaplan, was the current NAACP president and that he was the real leader of the organization rather than its African-American frontman, Roy Wilkins. Although the public perceived Wilkins as the NAACP leader, the paper asserted that he actually had the lower rank of national secretary. The argument of common sense was that the Jews led and supported the integrationist NAACP because they were opposed to powerful African-American nationalist leaders such as Marcus Garvey, and later those who led the Nation of Islam. Is it said that they really have no interest in African-Americans becoming self-reliant or self-supportive? It maintained that the Jewish leadership had an interest in racial pluralism, diversity, and conflict only because it would offer certain advantages to the Jews as a group. The other copy of Common Sense was no less startling. It had a long article asserting that international communism was a Jewish creation and that the Russian Revolution had not really been Russian at all. Jews had supposedly financed and led communism since its inception, and that they still thoroughly dominated the communist movement in the United States and around the world. This National Enquirer of the Right quoted many names, dates, and sources to support its incredible allegations. I was very skeptical of his assertions. But the information was too compelling to ignore. I had learned early on not to easily dismiss unpopular opinions. Despite the article's strong documentation, the allegations seemed too bizarre to be true. How could it be that the largest and most powerful African-American organization in America had been founded, financed, and run by Jews, and Marxist Jews at that, instead of African-Americans? How could something so incredibly amazing be kept so quiet that most people would not even know about it? If the Russian Revolution was truly a revolution led by Jews rather than Marxist Russians, why was such an enormous historical fact ignored in our history books and in our popular media? Furthermore, I could not understand why wealthy and powerful capitalist Jews would foster race mixing and communism. Father had often talked to me about the evils of communism, and I had been thoroughly anti-communist since reading books such as The Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater, None Dare Call It Treason by John Stormer, and You Can Trust the Communists to Be Communists by Frederick Charles Schwartz. These books and others impressed upon me the penetration of communist ideology throughout our society, media, and government. The Cuban Missile Crisis had occurred just 3 years before, and Father's plans to build a fallout shelter were still fresh in my mind. He had even purchased food and other survival supplies for it. During that period, the idea of nuclear war grew from an abstract idea to concrete anticipation. In the early 1960s, most communities tested their working order of air raid sirens by sounding them daily at noon. Sometimes when we lost track of time in school, the noon air raid sirens went off. We wondered for a moment if the war had actually come upon us. During the Cuban crisis, most American adults rationalized that thermonuclear war would not happen because it must not happen, because the very thought was too monstrous to contemplate. An 11-year-old is much more prone to believe that someone might pull the switch. Years later, the world discovered that we had actually teetered much closer to nuclear war than most Americans had known at the time. The fact that I viewed communists as putting my family in real danger of nuclear incineration contributed greatly to my visceral anti-communist stance. One of the common sense issues mentioned a full-page newspaper article written by Winston Churchill called Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People. The article had originally appeared in the Illustrated Sunday Herald on February 8, 1920. Churchill had maintained that the world's Jews were being torn between an alliance to communism on the one hand and Zionism on the other. Churchill hoped the Jews would adopt Zionism as an alternative to what he called diabolical and sinister Bolshevism. In his well-written article, contemporary with the early years of the Russian Revolution, Churchill described communism as a sinister confederacy of international Jews who have, quote, gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire. The article shocked me enough that I had to check its authenticity. It turned out to be genuine. In fact, I found some Jewish references to it, bewailing the fact that Churchill's article gave fodder to the anti-Semites of the world. The following is an excerpt from his amazing article, and I quote, "In violent opposition to all the spear of Jewish effort rise the schemes of the international Jews. The adherents of this sinister confederacy are mostly men reared up among the unhappy populations of countries where the Jews are persecuted on account of their race. Most, if not all, of them have forsaken the faith of their forefathers and divorced from their minds all spiritual hopes of the next world. This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky in Russia, Bela Kun in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality, has been steadily growing. And now at last, this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of this enormous empire. There's no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. Unquote. As important an historical figure as Churchill was, he was still only one voice. I rationalized that he could simply be wrong about the nature of the Russian Revolution. One of the Common Sense articles I read referred to a series of explosive documents, complete with file numbers, from the National Archives in the United States. So I wrote to my local congressman, F. Edward Hebert, and asked if his office would obtain copies of the files for me. A couple of weeks later, on returning home from school, I found waiting for me a large manila envelope from the congressman. Tomorrow I will share with you what I found in those startling documents and continue with my exposé of the so-called Russian Revolution. Until then, this is David Duke, and please help us spread this message all over the Internet and all over the world. Thanks. See you tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.